It's been just over a year since I began talking to people for this podcast. When it began, I was really nervous. I felt really vulnerable, opening up to people, talking about such a sensitive topic and something that brought up so many difficult feelings for me. Listeners of the show will know that I felt angry, I felt sad, I've laughed, and I've cried a lot. And though we've talked at length about grief being a messy personal journey with no linear path, I think the last year and two seasons of open and honest conversations have helped me arrive at a different place. I still miss my mom every single day, but I recognise my grief more and know how to handle it a little bit better. This season on Death Becomes Him, I talk to people who've experienced unimaginable loss. Each of their stories is unique, but as always, there is one commonality. Talking about it is therapy. On this episode of Death Becomes Him, I talk to Kathy Stritch. Kathy's family rallied around her sister Elaine when she was diagnosed with cancer in 2014. After rigorous treatment, life was getting back to normal in 2015 when Elaine's husband Pa suffered a fall and sadly passed away. Just over a year later, Elaine's cancer returned and she too sadly passed. Kathy opens up about caring for her sister's children, their fundraising efforts to honour Elaine and Pa, and how their wider friends and family will ensure Jason and Adam will always know their parents. Kathy, Katie, how are you?
I'm wonderful.
It's so funny. When I seen your name, I was like, how do you, it's yeah. And then I went on to Sheila Shoiga's podcast, which you had done with her, and I thought it was an amazing episode. And I was listening to Sheila's pronunciation of your name, and I went, it's Kathy with a K-A-T.
Like, I just take anything. Anything that goes Katie, Kathy, Catherine, I have had it all.
Pronounce your surname.
Stritch.
Stritch.
Very weird.
Is that an Irish name?
It is, actually.
It is an Irish name. I love the way you went. It is actually.
Yes, weirdly enough. A lot of people think it's German.
Yes, I would have thought European, but not Irish.
No, like any Googling I've done, it's originates in Limerick. And apparently it's the old Irish word for a street. So
okay, I don't know if that's insulting or is that shade? She works on the street, wink, wink. When I think of the name Kathy, yeah, all I think of is Mrs. Brown's Boys and the daughter, Kathy. Oh, Kathy. Kathy. So that's how I was thinking. Kathy. Welcome to your episode of Death Becomes Him.
I can't believe I'm here.
Thank you so much for agreeing to have the conversation. They're not easy conversations have.
Yeah.
And we are quite far away from each other with this huge glass barrier in between us. Mm-hmm. But let's try and make it as approachable as we can. I listened to your podcast with Sheila Shoiga and I was unaware of the level of grief in your life. I knew about your sister Elaine. I did not know about Elaine's husband, Pa. I was unaware of that and the accident and then him losing his mom, which we'll discuss. But you come off so positive and fun. Is that a decision you make every day that you're going to try and be as positive as you can?
Do you know, I think, like, I question myself on that. I'm like, you know, am I forcing myself to be this way? But I'm not. And I think the thing that I've really learned about grief is you can be sad and happy at the same time, you know, because I do have moments like, you know, obviously we've had a lot of stuff happen in our family. And like, maybe if you had met me a year afterwards, I wouldn't have been so bright and bubbly. But in saying that, like, I've always kept the bright side out. And even though it's a lot of trauma and a lot of grief, it's there with me. But you can still have fun. Yeah. You know, that's the thing. Like, you can still be happy and carry the grief with you, you know?
Yeah. I was kind of adamant that I made the decision that I was going to live my life in the way I thought my mom would want.
Yeah.
And I was still going to carry on, I hate to say the word as normal, but as normal as I could.
Yeah. How long is your mom?
It's 3 years.
3 years.
Just gone 3 years.
My partner, he's now my fiancé.
Yes, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, I think you put the picture up on New Year's Eve, but did you get engaged you got engaged on Christmas Eve.
Yes, yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Can we see the bling?
The bling.
Oh, look at the bling. My eyes.
But when we got back together, because we'd been together before.
I quite liked that story.
Yes, because you're the same, right?
Yes, we are completely the same. And then it was almost like he came back to you.
He did.
When Elaine was no longer around. Because when I listened to your full story, it's like one of those things you thought, this is a book or it's a movie. Mm-hmm. It was full of hope, your story. I think it's romantic.
Yeah.
I think it's sad. But then you have baby Freddie. You're now engaged. There's so many emotions and feelings through your whole grief journey.
My whole life has changed as well. Yeah. Like, so what, when I go back to what I'm saying with him, when we first went out, I used to laugh like a lunatic. Like, there was no one funnier than him. And then he literally came in the door. Literally, the way I see it is that, like, one door closed and another one opened. Like, she was the closest thing to me, my sister.
Yeah.
Like, she was my plus one nearly, you know? And literally, the week that she died, he came back because he needed to be there for me. But, you know, it was maybe 3 months after she passed away. I remember clearly one day in the car, and I've told him this, where I remember thinking, oh shit, he's not as funny as I thought he was.
You're blaming it all on him. Nothing to do with you or what you're going through.
Nothing to do with me.
It's his fault.
Yeah, I'm like, oh my God, he's actually not the crack I thought he was.
Stephen's changed.
But I did not laugh for a solid 3, 4, 5 months. I found nothing funny.
Yeah.
For a long time. And that's like, you know, looking back, I've told him that and we laugh and I'm like, God, for a while I was like, oh shit, wrong decision here. This fella's zero crack. Yeah. But like, that's where I was for a while. It was just like your head. I think your head goes so busy that you don't hear anything. You're too busy turning it over in your head.
Because you're overthinking and you're coulda, shoulda, wooding and what if. And it's like you're so consumed with the grief and what's going on that it completely takes over your whole body.
Yeah, there's no room for jokes and like you're not present. Like even on that note, I remember maybe 3 months after Elaine died, I went straight through a red light one night. Like, I don't know how, like I went between two cars.
Yeah.
But that'll show you the level of fog in your head. You're not there. You're not there at all. So, I mean, I could still go through a red light some days, but
probably not as fast. Safety first, yes. Kathy.
But that fog is not there anymore. But I think it's in the early days, it's quite hard. But I've always kept a good positive outlook, I suppose, you know.
You had an amazing relationship with your sister, Elaine. You were like best friends.
Yeah.
Talk to me about her. What was she like?
So she was like me, very like upbeat, and she was, to me, she was a year and a half older, but she felt like she was 10 years older. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I was like the clown. Like,
she was the serious sister.
She was married at 22 and she had the house and, you know, what the hell is this one doing with her life, you know? But
poor Kathy needs to get her shit together.
Single.
Why can't she be more like Elaine?
But we were very similar in that, like, you know, music, and we got the same jokes, and like what I'm saying is she would look after me a lot. Like, I always felt like she was like a second mother, you know,
right.
Like Elaine would give out to you and she'd be like, cop yourself on her. You know what I mean?
I think it's because, you know, I've 6 sisters and I almost feel like only your sisters can give out to you.
Yes.
But then ask if you're okay afterwards.
Yeah.
It's that, like, relationship.
So, like, I'm a personal trainer, but I have classes, not anymore since this whole thing, but...
What thing? What's happened? Why aren't you doing your classes?
But, like, I would ring her for the honest opinion. So I used to do my classes in a small village, and... You know, like if someone died, for example, I'd be like, do I do the class? Do I have the music pumping?
Of course,
Britney Spears,
out of respect, absolutely.
Pumping. Will I do? Will I stop the class? And like, she would be the one to absolutely, yes, you need to not have the class.
Okay.
But I find now, like, no one's there. No one's going to give you that honesty. A friend will say, oh, whatever you think, you know, where she'd be like, no, don't do it. She can't do it. You know, it was just that relationship where you could count on her, the loyalty, you know, if there was ever anything, she would stand by you no matter what. And I'm sure you know that from your own sisters.
Yeah.
Like, you can't, it's very hard to find that again, you know.
It's almost like, I think with my sisters and with my mom, we're all best friends. And before, I used to be kind of embarrassed. I said, what sort of idiot says their sisters and their mom are their best friends? Because it sounds, I used to always be embarrassed. And now I go, well, yeah, my mom is my best friend. And I still struggle with the was and is. It's so funny. But my sisters all live in the same village, all in Rathang in County Kildare, bringing up all their children together. And they are best friends.
Yeah. I think that relationship strengthens too when you get a bit older, doesn't it? Like, I mean,
I think you're wiser and you know what's important.
It took me a while. I mean, when I was younger, I mean, I'd barely, you know, look at her some days, you know, to kill each other.
Yeah.
But, and that's what makes me a little bit sad, because I feel now like, oh God, if she was here now, I think we would have just got closer and closer and closer. You know what I mean?
But
especially since the path I'm on now is very similar to hers, where it wasn't when she died.
Talk me through Elaine's diagnosis and when you guys kind of realized, oh, something's wrong.
Yeah. So it was in 2014. She was married, happily married with two babies. The youngest was one.
So young.
Yeah, so young.
So young.
And she just kind of was getting headaches and different things. She would be the type that would get migraines and headaches anyway, but they were severe, because there was one evening I was there, and I remember, I think we'd been at a funeral or something. What else?
Local village. Of course it was a funeral.
So we went back to her house, and she was literally running me out of the house. You know, she switched off the light and, like, hint, hint, get out. And it was about 8:30 or 9. And I was like, oh, and she wanted to go to bed because she'd such a bad headache.
Right.
And I thought that was really weird, you know. But anyway, she got diagnosed. She had a scan in Castlebar Hospital. And on the day, they told her, you have a tumor, 3-centimeter tumor in your head, a brain tumor. And so, you know, from there, we, you know, I went to the hospital to her, and the following Friday, she had surgery to remove the tumor.
That's quite quick.
Yeah. But there's no hanging around with the brain tumor, like, you know,
which is a good thing, obviously.
Yeah. So it was the following week that she went, and, you know, fantastic surgeons in Beaumont to take out a brain tumor. It's very different to taking a breast tumor or something out, because you can kind of take tissue
There's
around.
There's only so far you can go.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You can't with your brain. It's so precise. So, you know, we were always told, you know, if there's any sort of a cell left behind at all, the chance of this cancer that she had, it was a grade 4 gliosarcoma, it was called, the chance of that coming back was very high.
Right.
So they did tell her initially on that first diagnosis day. So after they took the tumor out, they biopsied it and brought her back and gave her the news that it was cancerous. So, you know, they did tell her on that day that this is going to significantly reduce your life expectancy, I suppose. And of course, I went onto the internet Googling, and worst place that
Do
you can go.
Not Google.
Yeah, Dr. Google. But I like to know. And, you know, the average life expectancy is, you know, up to 5 years,
5 years
from
right.
diagnosis. So,
and this was 2014.
2014.
So you were thinking you have her to at least 2019.
Yeah, but I think on that day, we started to grieve there and then, because you're like, this is not something that you're expecting. And straight away, you start imagining life without her straight away, even though she's there. So, so, I mean, she was good after that. She had her treatment and all the rest of it. So she was very well in terms of how she reacted. You know, in my head, I thought, oh God, you know, what goes with chemo is lose all the hair, getting sick. But
getting
she didn't really have that.
And look sick.
Yeah, she never did.
Wow.
No, she
so
never
she
did.
Still, she didn't lose her hair, she looked like herself?
She did, like they shaved the side of her head
right.
to operate, but she made the decision not to shave her hair.
Right.
And you would never have known. And
wow.
she didn't lose it with the chemo. Some chemos you do, others you don't.
Right.
But she
so
didn't
So she
lose
didn't
it.
Look like someone
no.
who was sick.
Not at all.
Which is probably a good thing.
Yes. Yeah.
Was
probably.
She quite upbeat and positive about it all?
I mean, she was in the beginning. She was knocked for six.
Of course. So shocking.
Yeah, it's so shocking. And, you know, she kind of she used to cry a lot over, like, you know, why did I have to get it in my head? You know, if I might have a chance if I got it somewhere else.
And then two very young children.
Two babies. So she had her chemo, day one chemo on his first birthday. Like, it was just sick. Ridiculous, when you think. But she was very positive. And yeah, she was very positive, and she was up and she was at it. And there did come a stage where we thought, okay, that's done. And actually.
Did you?
Yeah. And we were like, I know the doctor said that, but, you know, we very much said, there's always where they get it wrong, and you cling to, you hear a story here and there where this guy had this tumor and he lived for 15 years, you know? So we did kind of say, there's no point in dwelling on it. But however, I do think we always lived our life knowing she may not be here.
Yeah.
So were you as carefree as you were, or were you still thinking if she ever called you, in the back of your mind, you were going, shit, this could be bad news again?
I was from the day that happened. My life changed in that. My anxiety around a phone call. And then it only just got worse after that.
Because it triggers so much pain.
My God. Like the anxiety that it gives you. I suppose the first phone call that she gave me definitely rattled me a little bit. But then, the way it played out with us was she would have a checkup every 3 months. So every 3 months, that's when I was like waiting for the news.
Okay, so they would monitor her every 3 months
to see if there's any reoccurrence.
Okay, well, that's quite cool because it's a short space of time.
And if
there were to see anything, then hopefully catch it in enough time.
Yes, but on the flip side of that, you could never breathe because
It's so intense.
You didn't say, okay, we'll see you next year. She never got, come back in 2 years' time.
See it was always 12 weeks.
Yeah, it was three months. And he was always hanging over us, always. So, there was always nerves when she was going for her scans. I would go to some with her and my brother would take her and, you'd just be waiting for the text and she would just text because she'd just say, all good. And you'd be like, great. And then you could breathe. But then you had another scan coming in 3 months,
What was your relationship like with Elaine during that time from her diagnosis to, having the operation?
I mean, we definitely did more in terms of life. She wanted to live more and do things and go on holidays and
make memories.
Yeah, 100%. It definitely shook her into, this could happen. As I said, like the diagnosis itself, you grieve there at that moment because it's like, it's the difference between a sudden death and an illness is you start from the very moment they say, look, you could die very young from this, and then you're just, I think our relationship then, I suppose, in a way it's nice because you're more aware, of course you'd have your bitchy moments and your sharp comments.
That's
and
just
you
life,
know what I mean?
No matter
sisters,
who you are, what you're doing,
But there was always like a kindness there that, I just wanted to make sure to always do anything that she needed. And I'm glad, obviously I'm so glad now because I had no regrets, when she did die. I'm like, I had did everything. And I really she became my life because as I said on Sheila's podcast, I was single. So, it's different if you have your own family. I didn't have my own kids or anything. So
she was your family.
She
quite
absolutely
literally
was. Yeah.
I think in our age group or at our, we're encouraged to take pictures and videos.
Yeah.
There's some stuff that I can't look back on videos and pictures. How are you with that process?
Really good with it. As in, I did it from day dot. I would, while she was ill and while she was dying, there was videos and I would make sure that I had them. And she kind of really made sure that if you have videos, keep them, save them, all of that. But I did it from the start because of the fact that I felt like if I leave it, it's going to be too hard. Mm. And also I wanted to, for the first few months after she died, the boys spent a lot of time with me, her sons, and they would watch the videos and they wanted to watch the videos with me a lot. And so I remember asking a counselor at the time, what's the right thing? Is it going to upset them? And he said, just act normal, do what you always do. And I had the fear that they would forget what she sounded like.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to turn around when they're 18 and go, okay, here's a video of your mother and send them sideways.
They're like, who's that?
Do you know, I wanted them to, it to be normal, to hear her voice, to see her if and when they want it. Not that it had to be this big sit down and now we're going to show you a video because the time has come, So, she's everywhere. There's photos of her everywhere in my house and videos. I love looking at them. Yeah.
So during these checkups every 3 months, was Elaine quite confident that she was over this, that it had passed and was focusing on living a kind of regular life?
Yeah, I mean, she was. But you know what? At the end of the day, she was no fool either to what the disease was. She knew the seriousness of it. So she always was wringing her hands with nerves when she'd be going for that checkup. So she knew that there's always going to be a chance that today's the day is the bad news. But she did try.
God, when you say it like that, it makes me feel so anxious.
Yeah. So she definitely was positive and she was, trying to say, I don't think it's going to come back. I actually recall one conversation we're sitting at the kitchen table and she just said to me, I think that the doctors are wrong, Do you think that maybe, I don't think I'm going to get it back. Do you think I will? And I mean, You all, obviously, I was going to say, no, I don't think you will either. Because you're not going to say, yes, I do. I think you will.
Burst that bubble.
Yeah. So like, you know, and she was confident at a point that she may get it back, but maybe way, way, way down the road, you know. So she was living life, you know, in terms of thinking that she's done with it. And then she did get very fit and healthy, and she was as good as I've ever seen her. And she was full of life.
Yeah.
Great fun, like, you know. Like, I'm so aware of things can happen. And I don't, I have such a positive outlook on life. But I'll always, I'm not cautious, but I'll always know, I'm aware. And I think it actually helps me to live my life in a better way because, you know, I'm aware that I could get hit by a bus. I'm aware that I could get cancer. I'm aware of all these things. So therefore, I'm like, let's do it. You know, we might be here tomorrow. And I feel like I'm strong enough to take on the truth of things and hope that they don't happen.
During all of this, when Elaine is getting better, her husband is Pa, and Pa's mom passes away. Talk to us about that and then what led up to Pa losing his life also.
So his mom had been ill. She had had cancer, but she had made a recovery as well. She was a young woman, you know, she was not old by any stretch of the imagination at all. And she hadn't been feeling well, but she was in recovery. You know, she wasn't ill at the time, but she was taken back into hospital and she died very unexpectedly in hospital. And so, you know,
just you're saying there about cancer, how cancer affecting on both sides, his wife and his mother. That's a lot for him to take on, isn't it? The two women he loves most.
And I mean, he was a he was a tough guy, but I mean, as in a strong man, but it broke him.
It
broke him. I remember when Elaine got her diagnosis, like I had to go over and bring her back to our house because he was getting sick that day because they had given her diagnosis. So it absolutely broke him. So his mom had passed away and, you know, they were preparing for her funeral and they needed lights out the back because there was no lighting for people coming to the house. And so he was erecting a light and it basically catapulted him. It was on a strap and it just kind of slipped and catapulted him. So her funeral was to be, I could get a bit mixed up in the days, but I believe her funeral was to be that evening. And he fell, so it was absolute pandemonium. You know, his home house was about 3 miles, 4 miles from their house.
Right.
So I was there with Elaine. So we went over and we were there on the scene. And
how serious it was?
I didn't. Really?
Did Elaine know?
She got the call and she just was rattled. She knew because, you know, this is the thing. It's like there's so much that words, you know, other things like body language and all of that, you know, she just knew by the energy, I guess, is
the
what I'm trying to say.
Yeah,
she knew this
bad.
Is serious. They didn't say it was serious, but she knew. So, yeah, when we got over there, like, I wasn't expecting it to be anything. Like, I thought it was, you know, that he'd fell and broke something.
Stitches in his forehead.
Yeah.
Twisted his ankle.
Exactly. But when we got there, like, he was just in a very, very bad way. I went to try and help. There was some men trying to hold him in place, you know, in case he broke his neck or whatever. But he wasn't really conscious. He was somewhat conscious. But I did go down with them and I was holding his hand and all of that. The ambulance came and they realized it was very serious. So they called for a helicopter.
Yeah. When you hear of a helicopter being involved, you know that this is life threatening.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we didn't really think, I don't know, like I knew it was really serious, but you're just in, you know, you're in a mode where you remove all the feelings. And actually, I remember when the helicopter left that I started shaking from head to toe, even though I'd been there for about an hour. And I now know that that was adrenaline. It just went down through my body and I started shaking like hell, uncontrollable. But it was just adrenaline. So when we got up there anyway, you know, the news was grim and he passed away 2 days later. He was on life support for 2 days, but he passed away so unexpectedly.
It's so bizarre that he's going through the trauma of his wife's diagnosis, and that during that point, being optimistic, she was still, you know, living her life and healthy-ish and going back every 3 months. His mom also kind of in the same predicament, recovering from the exact same disease. Him, to everyone's knowledge, completely healthy.
Yeah.
And then the one person you probably weren't worried about, which was him, getting ready for his mom's funeral, is the one that dies because of a tragic accident. You kind of have to think, how do you get your head around that? What is that?
It's totally insane because, you know, Elaine even said that. She said, you know, he was the fittest, healthiest. He never smoked. You know, he was a healthy, healthy man. He had no, he'd never been to the doctor maybe once, I think, his whole life. He'd never been sick. And so she would say, you know, that just goes to show you, you know, you can be like, don't eat this and don't eat that and stay healthy. And then you're killed in an accident, you know, so you just never know. But yeah, I mean, and that's why I suppose I can kind of somewhat empathize with you and the suddenness. That's where like his death to me threw me, because I couldn't wrap my head around it. I stayed in Beaumont for 2 days as well. We just went straight there. Didn't come home until he passed away. But when I came home, I remember going into their room, you know, because I used to stay in Elaine's house, and I was getting ready or whatever. He was coming home or whatever. And I just remember looking at his pillow, and I was fixated on the pillow going, his head was on that pillow. And he got up and he never knew that he would not be on that pillow again tonight. It's insane.
You know, he's going down to his home house, you know, where he grew up as a boy, as a child. He's safe. He's getting ready for his mom's funeral. He's putting up a light. It's like, are you religious?
No, I wouldn't say I am. But in saying that, like, I love our local priest because he brings me so much peace, because he's been there for so much. He was there for Paz, he was there for Elaine's, yeah. He was there for so much that, like, I love him as a man. I'm a religious, no. I get a lot out of things like anniversary masses, but I guess it's because you feel supported and you feel that that's a time to mark that person. And so that's why I do like masses,
right?
In that sense.
It's what they symbolize.
Yeah.
It's remembering that person.
Yeah.
Did you find, because Elaine in your mind was okay and she was still with you, did you find Paz passing more shocking, and you're saying you couldn't get your head around it?
I think that, like, in hindsight, they're just different.
Mm.
But I do think, so his was no goodbye. You know, there was no goodbye. Although, I mean, I had, and I'm thankful that I was there that morning and I got to speak to him and I got to talk. He went out the door. I watched him go out the door. I'm really grateful that I had that. But for me, it was extremely traumatic. Like, even just the whole scenario, the helicopter, and you're like, oh my Jesus. But yeah, I definitely found it, out of the two, it definitely has left a lasting effect on me. In that, like, my anxiety, like, I'm scared of things. I'm afraid people are going to die and things like that. My own mortality. Like, I would be afraid to do things now in case I would fall. And you can't go around dodging things. But I'm terrified of, you know, if Stephen's climbing a ladder, I'm like, be careful and you could fall down. And, you know, it's just really, it taught me a massive lesson that it can end in a second, literally in a second, to anyone. It doesn't matter who you are, what you do, what you have, it's gone. And then there's no, like, to see that I couldn't help him. No one could help him. No one could wake him up. You know, I remember Elaine coming into his room saying, please wake up, please wake up. And he wasn't going to wake up, you know.
Talk to me about then Elaine and where you guys kind of thought, oh, we have an issue here with her health.
So it was about a year later. So it was past first anniversary.
And during that year, was she, I don't want to say good spirits, but was she living her life?
Oh, like you wouldn't believe living her life.
Right.
She was doing it all in 1 year.
She was doing it all. You're not saying, girl.
Yeah, she was. She just, I don't know how she did it. I mean, she was like, she was beyond broken. And she just did everything. And, you know, she started like, going on nights away, and she'd be like, let's go here, let's go there. And she did a fitness event with me, the Tough Mother thing. She did, she joined my classes and she became really into that. And I do recall her saying that to me, like she said, I have to be well. I cannot get sick here. I am all that these two boys have.
Well, yeah, her maternal instincts kicked in. The mama bear kicks in.
Yeah, and she just didn't want, she didn't want to have them to have a bad, not a bad life, but she wanted to stay really happy for them, you know. And I know that she was just brokenhearted, but she just, she, like the zest that she had was unbelievable, you know. She was just, she was just really, really upbeat and positive for that full year, and so much fun. And like, we did so many things, and that's why I'm so happy we went to Kirkpatrick. We did.
You're smiling when you talk about this.
Yeah. Which was just great crack, like, too, you know.
And when you say that first year, the first year is the hardest, longest year. And you know yourself, when you go through grief and loss, the first year can feel like, it's weird because it can feel like 5 years, then it can feel like 6 months.
Yeah.
But the first year, I always find, is the toughest one to find your feet, because you're almost looking for a new identity.
Yeah.
You but are.
You're also replaying everything. Like, I found that too. It's the first birthday that comes around. It's the first Valentine's Day, say, in her case. The first everything that came around. I even recall their first wedding anniversary, and I took her for dinner. You know, there was all those things. And like, don't get me wrong, as she had moments where you would come in and she just, you know, she wasn't even able to talk. Mm. She'd be just so brokenhearted.
What age was Elaine at this when she lost Pa?
She would have been 34.
So young to be a widow.
Yeah.
Isn't it, to me, a widow was someone, an older lady, an old woman, 70, 80 years of age.
But we used to laugh. This is the thing. Like, she would make jokes. Yeah. She'd be like, can I get the widow's pension now? Yeah.
But you joke with, look, I think you're a bit like me when it comes to humour. Yeah. I've really,
dark humour.
Yeah, I've really had to kind of really rely on all aspects of humour from everyone.
Yeah.
Because I used to always say, if I don't laugh, I'll cry.
Yeah. I mean, we used to have such laughs. I mean, she was such, and this is the thing that I miss so much about her. Is I can't laugh in the same way with anyone that I did with her. And you know what's funny? Because I was thinking of this, it reminded me so much of, I have told this story to my friends so many times about her ringing me one day. It's one of my favorite memories, but it was about Big Brother.
Right.
So she rang me one day and she said, where are you? I was like, why? What's wrong? She said, have you watched Big Brother? I was like, no. Oh, please, can I tell you what happened? I was like, no, you can't.
You're like, don't ruin it for me.
Please tell me. Please, please, can I tell you? Please, can I tell you? I was like, no, you can't tell me. And it turned out it was the episode, you know, where David is dead.
Oh, yes.
And she was weak laughing.
Yes, that's very funny.
Oh, my God almighty. We just howled laughing. And the, you know the thing when,
and Tiffany Pollard, I think, is one of the best reality TV people ever.
But she was so like, please go home and watch it. And then she was crying laughing. I thought she was crying, but she was laughing so much that she sounded like she was crying. But you know, those are the things that you miss too, because it came up the other day that it was 5 years ago. And I was like, I can't tag her.
I know. Isn't it so funny though? Yeah. And stuff like that you're not thinking about it at the time. Of course you're not. But it's those unique moments that you share that you never be able to share with anyone else, because she was your only sister.
But that's what a relationship is, isn't it? When you think about it, with everybody, it's your own one-on-one personal little things that no one else in the world can replace. And that's why grief is so hard, because once that person is gone, there is no replacing that, you know.
You have to be able to work through it, so it just doesn't lead you down a dark, horrible road.
Yeah, I mean, I put an awful lot of it on Stephen's poor head. You know, I'm constantly.
That's what fiancés are
that's
for.
That's what they're
Kathy.
For, and he
not boyfriends,
loves it.
Fiancés.
Fiance.
Thank
that's
you.
The first official.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I mean, he is brilliant in that. I get to say the things to him and the memories and he knows it inside out. Like, I mean, I remember we were at a wedding one day, me and him, and he's so good that he came in. I was with somebody else and he heard, you know, the parting glass.
Yeah.
We played that as she left the church. The version by Ed Sheeran, and he left what he was doing, and I knew, and I said it to my friend. I said, I bet you any money Stephen's going to arrive here now.
Yeah, and he did.
And he did, because he knew. He was like, just want to see if you're okay and everything okay.
What is it with Ed Sheeran with these heartbreaking songs that mean so much? For us, it's Supermarket Flowers.
Yes, we played Photograph for on like, her we went to Ed Sheeran, me and her together.
Oh, okay, so that's yeah. that's a whole that's,
yeah, yeah, that's a whole other thing. Yeah, is that why the Supermarket Flowers?
Flowers is yeah, someone had contacted me on Instagram saying I should listen to the song.
Oh, God.
And I listened to the song, and it, we then Arthur compiled this videos and pics of Mom for a few minutes, and that song plays over.
But
so
it's
when
kind
I hear
of
it now,
therapy.
It is therapy, and yeah. I fully believe it, but there's just sometimes where I'm like, not today.
Yeah.
Can't listen yeah. to it today.
But I suppose as time has gone on as well, I am a little bit better with handling that that side of my grief, you know.
So you came up to the first anniversary. Elaine, yeah. as we said, she's living her life.
Mm.
You've no concerns, though, that obviously you have concerns for her that her, you know, her husband, her best friend have passed. But you've no concerns regarding the diagnosis from before.
Yes and no.
Right.
Because she did start, you know, it was his anniversary, and it was that weekend that she left my class with a really, really bad blinding headache. And like, it's straight away, you are worried because you're thinking, oh God, are we going down this again? Could it be that? But coupled with the fact that it was his anniversary, we were kind of thinking, well, maybe she's just, you know, having a rough few weeks. And so she started going to the doctor and going to the hospital and all of that. And she progressively got worse. But the problem was, they were telling her she was fine, that there was nothing wrong. You know, she went for scans, she went for MRIs. And every time she would come home, she was just progressively getting weaker. She was, you know, vomiting, her headaches, her head was killing her. And we would go in and out to A&E nearly every weekend. And it started at his first anniversary, like just after that. So, and because she'd been so well, and because it had happened around that time, we started thinking, well, I don't know, maybe she's just, it's just all too much. And
she's having a breakdown.
Yeah. So we just, but every time it was like in a medical emergency to us, we would bundle her up and put her into the car and bring her because she was in that much pain. So we would go to A&E and they would do all the scans and do all the tests, and there's nothing there. There's no tumor on your brain. We'll see what happens. Go home. Come back again, and it went on for ages. And you know, she was losing weight. She was clearly very ill,
yeah.
very ill at home. Like, she was getting sick, and we could see it, but there was nothing we could do. And she started, because we were doing the one thing you do is go to the hospital, and they were just saying, no, she's fine.
Why do you think there were, if she was losing weight and she was in physical pain, did you think that they thought it's all in her head?
I wouldn't say that they did, in fairness to them.
Right.
But doctors are very step by step. You know, they have their checklist. Okay, you have a history of a brain tumor. Let's scan your brain. Okay, yeah. There's nothing there.
Yeah, I know what you
there's
mean.
There's nothing there.
They're not looking for it anywhere else.
Yeah. And what? You have a headache and you're getting sick. That doesn't necessarily mean anything to them. And what they would do is give her something for the pain. And then the pain.
She'd feel fine.
She'd be great.
And they send her home.
Yeah.
And then it happened again.
Again and again and again and again. And I was at my wit's end.
Yes.
Because my whole life literally was teaching my class, coming home, bringing her to the hospital, sitting in the hospital with her, going to my class, bringing her home from the hospital. She couldn't drive because of her history of the brain tumor.
Of course.
But she became so weak and so ill.
When you guys turned up at the hospital, were the doctors like, ah, oh, Jesus, here,
here
they go
again. Here they are again.
Like, you can imagine you're thinking that, aren't you? They're like, oh, what's wrong with her today?
One of the problems was that we are from a border village. And so she would go between two hospitals.
Okay.
So that didn't really help in that
yes.
she wasn't always seeing the same people.
I know. And you are you starting from scratch again?
Every time.
Each time you're
yep.
bringing in.
Hi,
surely
we're here
though,
again.
When you give Elaine's name, you would like to think the medical history, quick diagnosis. Okay, so this is where
no,
we're at.
No, because they go by a chart. It's not even on a computer
right.
as far as I can see.
It needs to be on a computer.
Yeah, but it's insane. It's so like backwards, if you ask me. That's just my own opinion.
No,
but it's
and we all know that doctors do go above
and beyond.
And also they're only seeing a patient for a couple of minutes
yeah,
as well.
And, that, but
and
that
could be seeing
problem.
Different doctors, I presume, as well, right?
Yeah.
yeah.
And they were trying their utmost for her, but they just couldn't get to the bottom of it. And the problem was because of the bed situation. She was being passed from here to there to here to there, and she was in Castlebar 1 week and then she was in Galway the next week. Presenting with headaches. It didn't look like anything too serious to them. But then she did start to collapse. She did start to have fits. And that's when they kept her in Castlebar. But But Castlebar is like, I don't know what the equivalent would be, like maybe the Midlands. It's not a specialised hospital. They wouldn't have any neurosurgery in there. And so because of that, there was no one there equipped to kind of specialise in her history. So they were just taking care of her, you know, with pain medication. But there was no bed in Galway. So she ended up there for 2 weeks. And the
what happened during those 2 weeks?
It was horrible. It really was horrible. And that to me, it really upsets me when I look back and think of it, because they just left her there. Because, and again, I have to stress, I'm not saying anything about a doctor or a nurse, but they couldn't do anything with her. They would call Galway and there was no beds available. So what are they going to do?
They were doing their best,
yeah.
Well, yeah.
But she was a really, really sick 34-year-old girl, 35 perhaps at that time. She was really ill. And we were begging them. I was crying. I was saying, you have to do something, because she was as fit as me, you know, a couple of weeks ago. It's like she's just gone downhill and oh, we'll see what we can do. And like, they were only looking at the stint that they had, not the 8 previous visits to A&E. You know, okay, she's here 3 days now, sure, we'll see, you know. And for me, it was extremely frustrating. And eventually I got onto her consultant in Galway, and all we could do was to get her to go there for an appointment. And she had to be taken by ambulance. She couldn't walk. I mean, I had to shower her in Castlebar. That's how weak she was.
And that's, you know, to be in that position, that's also frightening, isn't it? When you're showering your 34-year-old sister, you just go, this is how serious this actually is.
It was really sad, because, again, those are the moments that I'm so glad that I could do it for her.
Of course.
And it was, there were tender kind of moments. You know, I remember her saying, her hair was so knotted because she couldn't move at this point either. As in, she couldn't lift her. So if you think of someone paralyzed, that's what she was like. Because of the fact it was in her brain stem, we came to turn to find out that controls your...
The cancer.
Everything. Yes.
Right.
And so we found out she couldn't drink. So I would have to physically pour the water into her mouth. I would have to feed her. Mm. And what makes me angry is when I look back, you know, a lot of the people would say, Elaine, come on, do it yourself. You're well able to. And I would get so upset saying she's not able to do it. She would do it if she could do it. She's not the type.
Why would she lie in bed with 2 young children?
Exactly.
At 34 and not feed herself?
So we needed to be there for her because she couldn't do anything. So I would carry her in, link her into the bathroom and all of that. But, you know, as I said, those moments were nice. I remember her saying, oh, she goes, you must hate me now. And I said, are you mental? Like, no way. I would do anything for her.
You were probably so happy that you were doing it for her.
Yeah, it was a privilege.
Yeah.
You know.
That's the thing. That's the word, privilege. Mm.
And her hair was knotted because she wasn't able to, you know, it was really knotted in her hair. And it took me a full hour and 3 bottles of conditioner to get the knots out of her hair. And we had a laugh.
She was like, ow, stop, stop.
I'm like, is it hurting you? Yeah. Obviously, 3 bottles later. But to look at that and think, that shouldn't be happening.
What age were the boys at this point? And they'd lost their dad. They're still super young.
There were 3 and 7.
You have these 2 young children at 3 and 7 that lost their dad. And now this with their mom. It's like, what do you do, Kathy?
I mean, it was like the whole atmosphere in our family. It was just, nobody had any clue really of the depth. You would never know unless you were going through it. It was pandemonium, like, because everyone in our immediate family was doing something, but at the same time, you're trying to keep her privacy and everything. Like, so it was down to us, you know. So it was our core family, and we were going between visiting her, helping her. Someone had to be with her in the end all of the time because she couldn't move and she couldn't feed herself. And no one is going to come, they're understaffed as it is, to come and sit and feed her. So we had to be with her. I had to try and juggle my own work. People didn't know I'd have to go in and go, okay, let's do some burpees. Yeah. You know, no one knew the depth of it. And the boys then were so young that we had to be at home a lot with them, taking care of them. Obviously, there was so much help and, you know, Pa's family and, you know, other people that would take care of them. But, you know, at that time, it was one of the most stressful times of my entire life. I don't think anything will ever top the stress of that.
It's also a lot of tragedy to hit one family.
Yeah.
So, isn't it? Like, you know, a son, a mom, and now, what his I mean, wife, your
in
sister.
The middle, my uncle died. We used to laugh.
It's another layer. Who next?
We would say, okay, we can't tell anyone about, because they'll say, oh, here they come again.
What are they doing in that house?
God's sake. But in the middle of it, like, that was my mum's brother. And he was very close to us. And he died in the middle of it. And we just didn't have time to, we had to park his because she was getting sick. And we had to look after her. That was our only goal. She was having fits and kind of seizures, which they thought maybe mental. You know, they thought, you know, I heard it being uttered, she needs to go to a psych ward, that this must be in her head. And then the day he said, you know what, she's in big trouble. She's gravely ill. This was the day that we had got her from Castlebar to Galway, and they checked her out, and yeah, okay, you know, there is something wrong. The cancer is back. We've done a scan. We can see it. There's his words were, there's a 3 centimeter tumor on her spine, but that's the least of her worries.
Wow.
And from then, like, a part of it was kind of like, almost like relief.
Yeah, because it's your aha moment.
Yeah.
Oh, we told you.
We knew.
But then you'd be angry going, so, we've been telling you this for how long? But then there's relief because you found what's wrong with her. Mm-hmm. And then you can go into trying to fix it.
Yes, but we knew she was at the end stage of cancer.
Right.
But that's why the anger, because he said those fits that she was having were from pain. So I'm like, you know, a person at that stage in their cancer journey would be well medicated and on palliative care. She wasn't getting anything, only tramadol or whatever.
She was living it and feeling it.
Yeah, she went through the whole thing all the way to
torture.
The end. Yeah, so the consultant was phenomenal, just a phenomenal man. He did everything that he could. He really, what they wanted to do was to get the fluid off her brain, because that's why she couldn't move. And it was for to try and prolong her life. That was it. There was no other options, really, in terms of chemo or any of that.
Radiotherapy, no. There's no point.
They did a spinal tap to try and drain the fluid. It didn't work. We went by ambulance to Beaumont. I went with her in the ambulance, and they did a shunt, which drains the fluid down into your stomach. But it may give her a better quality of life, but they said the trouble with that is your stomach, then the fluid travels to your stomach, and it can kind of speed up your, you know, the cancer is going to go straight throughout you, you know. But she had the shunt and it didn't really work. But from that day that she went in by ambulance to Galway, she died 3 weeks later.
Wow.
And she never came out of the hospital. You know, to us, it was really sad because she never got home. She never got to have a goodbye. She never, you know, and even though, you know, I know we talk a lot about the difference between a goodbye and a sudden death, but in hers, like, there wasn't a goodbye either, because she was so ill, and, you know, they just had to medicate her, and she didn't get to go home. She didn't know that this was going to be the end for her.
Did Elaine know that this was it for her, that she wouldn't be leaving hospital?
She had, you know, there was one conversation, I guess, you know, she was that ill that they were kind of speaking to us.
More so than her.
Yes. But they would speak to her too. I mean, don't get me wrong, they would go in, but they would tell us kind of first, and then they'd go in and tell her. And there was one conversation where he told her the shunt hasn't really worked. And she did know. She said, you know, I always remember that evening, because she summons everybody in. She was like, the boss, get in here, the lot of you. Where's Cathy? I was off down the corridor
quite
somewhere.
Like that. She was still calling all
machine.
The shots.
Oh my God. She
I
used
like
to
that.
Call the shots. And
you're at the vending machine.
Get in here. Yeah, of course.
Get that Mars bar out of your hand.
So she called us all in, but she just almost got a bit, you know, she started giving all the instructions. I want this to happen. I want you to do that. I don't want you to be fighting. You have enough heartache that you're going to...
As in funeral?
Yeah, no, she didn't really go through the funeral, but right. She knew, you know, stick together. You're going to have... I remember her words saying, you have enough heartache now coming up with all of this. But then we kind of came out of that night and didn't really talk about it again, because she needed to have hope.
Yeah, it's too real though as well.
You can't
it?
Like say, okay, this is it, I'm going. She knew, but at the same time, you know, she would be hopeful. She would talk about, when I get out of here, we'll do this, we'll do that. You know, she never really because if you don't have hope, like what's the point? You've nothing, yeah. You know? So even though she was aware, she kind of couldn't go there a lot, you know? We did bring her boys in to the hospital to her.
That must have been so difficult for them to even understand at that age.
They didn't, yeah. It was really, which really, is really hard. Better.
No, that they didn't understand.
I think so. But, you know, they even asked me recently about it. Mm. You know, they asked me, one of them asked me, what was her last word?
Yeah.
And I don't you don't have the answer for that, really, because just the way it played out, you know, she was just went into a sleep, I guess, towards the end. But I do have videos of that. Right. And which I think is important for them, mm-hmm. in years to come, so when that they know,
probably old enough to also understand the feelings that come with watching that.
Yeah, yeah. So they, you know, it was so hard to bring them in, so hard. You want to protect them, little kids. You don't want them to hurt, but it's inevitable. Like, you
but
know,
also you want to almost try and be as honest as you can as well.
You need
so
to
that
be.
They grow up almost in case someone else says to them in school or someone passes a comment. Yeah. That they know what they're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
Must be very difficult, you know, having the one sister, well, you have one sister, like to kind of know that this is it. It's time to say goodbye. Did you get a chance to say goodbye?
I feel like the weeks leading up to it was my goodbye.
Okay.
You know, I was with her a lot. Being, you know, female, I got to care for her, and it was the long goodbye.
Mm.
I didn't actually sit down and have a conversation with her and say goodbye, but to me it was my biggest honor to be able to help her when she needed help the most, because she always looked after me so much that for me that was my way of saying goodbye,
mm-hmm.
is caring for her all the way to the end. There was no goodbye, really. I think I didn't. I knew she was going to go, and in the end, I really wanted her to go.
Yeah, because she wanted her to be at peace.
Yeah, she was in because she was so in pain. Much pain,
mm-hmm.
That the day she went, I was just happy that she was gone on that day. But I guess you don't really realize what's coming after that, you know, and the loneliness that you'd feel. But yeah, and the heartbreak, the guilt of looking at her boys with no parents, you know?
Yeah, that's another level as well, because they're so young and they have no mom and dad.
My whole family shifted the dynamic, because now my parents, in a way, I lost my parents too, in a way, because they are now the parents of my nephews.
Yeah.
So they left their house there, and then they did an unbelievable thing in that they left their house that very day and never went back and moved into her house. And, you know, they should be retired. And, you know, my dad sent me a photo the other day and he's making a snowman,
right.
with the boys, and, you know, they're going to school and they have to do all these things. I mean, we were very involved. I've always been really involved with my nephews. Like, I feel like they're like my own. I see,
I know,
you
I'm,
with
I'm
Harvey.
Totally, yeah. The same.
Like, the
yeah.
exact same
we're
thing.
Obsessed.
They're mine.
Yeah.
And from day one, I was like that. And, so there was a while where, you know, we had to kind of figure out what's the new way, you know, and we kind of had to step back. I struggled with that, to be honest, because I was so used to being there with them that I struggled to, you know, to understand the new dynamic, that it was now my mom and dad were now their parents.
Yeah.
And like that whole relationship changed. I now, in a way, was the eldest because she was gone.
Mm.
And everything changes, your whole life. And I feel like that's the first step for me into grief with her. And again, it was a totally different grief to my brother-in-law. When it's your own flesh and blood, it's just, it tears your heart to think.
Because it's inside of you.
Yeah, like your mom is flesh and blood. It's a different thing where you think, you know, did they hurt? And, you know, were they in pain? And did they know? And were they scared? And you go through all of those questions and they really hurt you. But just this shuffling around of the family dynamic, like for me, I found that hard. I found, who am I now? Because I think I might be getting the ages mixed up. I think I was 33 when she died. But I thought, I've had 33 years with her in my life.
Mm.
There's no year that she hasn't been here. So now I'm in this world where she doesn't exist. You know what I mean? She's not there. So everything was weird and wrong. And, you know, you just feel like a fish out of water because everything has changed. Like, my parents no longer live in their home house. They're gone. They're my two pets, my nephews that I adore. They now have a different set of parents in a way. And it just everything was different. And it was really, really, really hard to step into the world and navigate that, you know?
Talk to me about Elaine's funeral.
Yeah, it was, it's a big blur, really. Hindsight and time having passed, I look back and I think even the parts, you know, where she was laid out at home, I couldn't, it was too much for me. That I remember maybe last year waking up one night in a panic going, I should have, like, I didn't, when I said goodbye, you know, when they were putting the lid on, I just gave her a quick kiss because there was a queue of people behind me and walked away. And then years later, this is more of the anxiety coming out, going, I should have stayed for longer. I should have held her hand for longer and all of these things. But I think during the funeral, I was just, I'd had, like, we were exhausted because we'd spent 6 weeks of 24/7 care and trying to juggle a life. We were exhausted and I just went into a mode where I just switched off. It wasn't happening. But I was there, but I was like having the chats and my friend flew home from England. I was like, oh my God, hello. And you know, everyone saw, oh my God, are you okay? I'm like, I'm fine, everything's fine.
That was my motto. I have it on t-shirts. Right. I'm fine, everything's fine. You're drinking tequila at 1 o'clock? I'm fine. Put the tequila down.
Until you're not.
Yes. But we all have a breaking point though.
Yeah.
Did you ever get to a breaking point where people went, you're not fine, you need to check yourself?
Yeah, I mean, there was, I think for the first year, I was fine, inverted commas. Yeah. And that's the time where people are looking at you the most, like, oh my God, are you okay? And if you're not doing so well, maybe you need to get some therapy. And that was my kind of aha moment, that what grief is about, that, no, I'm actually supposed to be bad. I'm supposed to be
feeling like this,
crying. I'm supposed to be upset. I'm supposed to be lonely, angry, raw, all of these things. That's what I'm supposed to be. You need to kind of embrace that. But people kind of were like, you know, obviously worried for me and saying it's a lot and you're still, I was back working 2 weeks later running my business. Go, 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 go. But I was happy in that bubble. And whether people want to say it or not, whether they say, oh, you know, she's in shock. I'm not in shock. I know what happened, you know. I'm just not ready to go through the motions yet. But you do what you do to survive. But I do think the second year, it caught up in me a little bit.
Right.
In terms of the anxiety and stuff. I mean, I used to get really struggle with sleep. I couldn't breathe properly with, the anxiety was just massive. And I think it just came from, it was physical anxiety, you know, where you have the tight chest and I would feel like my chest is in a vice. I can't breathe properly, worrying. And then I was pregnant and all of this had happened so quickly as well. I just think my life had just changed so much that I definitely was struggling with anxiety. And I suppose lows, I started to get quite low. But again, I felt like if I say this, I would have no problem in admitting it. But, you know, Stephen was helping me through it and I didn't need other help. I felt supported enough. But there were days where I woke up and I was just low for no reason. Like, no reason. I would just wake up and I would know today's a bad day.
Completely get that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was okay because I knew once I could talk about it, I feel I'm okay, I'll be fine. But then there was times where I would cry and I wouldn't know why I was crying for no reason. Because when I compared it to the early days, I would know why I was crying. Like I might cry and say, I heard a song today and I can't believe that Elaine will never hear this song. Mm-hmm. And that's my reason for crying. And then, you know, Jason and Adam, my nephews, would say something and break my heart. And I would know, I'm really upset because of that. And New Year's Eve, I was devastated because the new year was starting without her. And they were all reasons. But then it got to the point the following year where I don't know why I'm sad. I just feel really low and really sad. But yet you could get up and teach your class and be jolly and
turn
happy.
Turn it on.
Turn it on. And it kind of caught up a little bit where, you know, the anxiety part of it was just so, you know, I couldn't breathe with it. Worrying about things going wrong, overthinking, and this might happen. And what if this happens? And what if, you know, I had a pain in my leg. Maybe it's cancer. And so eventually I did go to my doctor, my GP, and she was phenomenal because I just said, look, I'm full of anxiety. And then, you know, 2 seconds later, like, where's the Kleenex? It all came out. So I feel like
it
maybe.
It does though, eventually.
It catches up with you. Yeah. Even though I am a strong person and I talk about it so much, I've always talked from day dot. That's my therapy. And I never felt like I was struggling with it. I just think it is what happened. It was a part of the
process.
Yeah, that I just am anxious after it and the anxiety got too much for me. So the doctor helped me. She gave me anti-anxiety medication. And like a part of me was a bit, oh God, am I going to become this like zombie?
Zombie, fully medded up. She lost her sister.
Yeah, aww. There she is.
I know, like she a statistic. Statistic? Am I saying that right? Statistic. What am I trying to say?
Statistic.
Thank you. That's the word.
But yeah, I thought, oh God, I'm going to be drugged up to my eyeballs.
Totally.
And lights are on, but there's nobody home. No. I'm the same upbeat, happy person. And what I felt when I gave them a bit of time was I thought, oh, holy shit, how hunched up I was.
Right.
Like I was constantly, I spoke to some girls recently. They're brilliant. They're called Jacinta Smile. They talk about grief a lot, but the way they described it was they were braced for impact. Mm. And that's what I feel I was until I started taking the medication. It just, I relaxed. Like I felt like my shoulders dropped down. I wasn't clenching my teeth and my fists. Like it's a physical thing. In my dreams.
Sounds so aggressive, doesn't it?
Yeah, but that's how I was.
Like you're ready for a fight.
Yes. And Stephen would tell you, like in the early days, I would wake up, I would lash out in my sleep. I was having nightmares. I was thrashing about the place, just all over the place. And I feel like I wish I did that sooner, went to the doctor.
Were you at all concerned what people were thinking about you?
Not really, to be honest, I wasn't.
Oh, just me then. I feel like shit now. Thank you.
yeah.
Just me, the bad son.
No, I think, you know what? Elaine set such a good example because I thought if she could get up and get out and have the crack and not really care what anyone thinks when her husband died, then I'm going to do the same thing. And yeah, I didn't because I feel like I really owned grief. And the way I looked at grief was it's just emotions, it's just feelings. Like, so you know if someone's like just got engaged or whatever.
Did you get engaged? Congrats. I didn't know.
I know, weird. But you know if someone
is his name Stephen? I know Stephen. He's been DMing me a lot.
Stop it. Slid into the DMs.
I'm saying nothing.
There you go.
I'm saying nothing.
Oh my God, you got engaged. Oh my God, you're expecting. Oh my God, that's fantastic. And people want to celebrate it. And to me, grief is the same thing on the flip side of that. But we're not supposed to talk about it really. We're supposed to stay quiet about it. If you fight it, I feel that you would have a harder time, you know, constantly trying to pretend you're not okay. Trying to pretend you're happy. That's what grief is. You're supposed to feel all of these emotions. And so I never hid it, you know. I publicly, to all of my friends or whatever, I would say I'm not doing well. The thing is also, that's what her death and his death has taught me. They're not here. Get your arse up and go and
get your
do
shit together
the thing.
And live your life.
Yeah, because how dare you not?
Where do you think they are? They're together now and what are they doing?
I don't know. I struggle with that. Right. I don't know. Are they together? That I don't know. I hope that they are. I would love if they were together and if they were happy. But I find that hard to navigate. I'm not sure. Do I believe in heaven, I suppose, and all of that? Do you feel when you look at the sky? I look at the sky, even though I don't believe in heaven per se, but I always look at the sky and feel like, well, that's where they are.
Yeah, actually, you're totally right. If I look up and it's a sunny day or if I see a rainbow or if anything, it's so funny you said that. Yeah, I do look to the sky. I always think it's everyone that's on this journey is you have to find peace with what works for you. Mm-hmm. And me thinking my mom's on a cloud doing all that works for me. That may not work for you, 100%. But it doesn't have to. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, I said, I'm not a professional. I'm not a counselor. I'm not a doctor. You know, this is just my journey of grief and what worked for me. It doesn't work for everyone. So talk to me about Grief Ireland and what Grief Ireland does.
So I decided, because I have my own fitness business page, I wanted to come on and talk about Elaine if I felt like it. And sometimes, I don't know if everybody wants to hear about that. I believe that it should be normalized, which is why I love what you do, because let's just talk about it. You know, it happens.
Death happens every day.
Happens to everyone. Yes. And guess what? It's going to happen to us too. So I think it's good to normalize the conversation and talk about it. But I do know, I'm aware that a lot of people, they mightn't want to hear about it too much. So I decided to just separate it and just set up an Instagram so that I could talk there. And it's lovely because it's a little community. I just wanted a particular place to just talk about it. And like, it's insane the amount of messages that I've got. It's a tiny page, but everybody has a story. Everybody wants to be heard. They're all unique and individual, but also everyone wants to relate to others. Like, I found that anyone that has lost someone, immediately, like, I gel with them, because you're in the inverted commas club now, yeah, aren't you?
You don't want to be in the club, but you're in it.
Yeah, but you're in the club.
You're a VIP member.
Absolutely. I feel like we need to have it accepted and normal that people want to share their stories, and they shouldn't have to feel
awkward or embarrassed.
Separate that. It's not a negative thing. They're difficult emotions, but it's not negative.
Thank you so much for this conversation. And what's been really good is, you know, the one thing that I wanted to do with these conversations was also to be able to inject humor into conversations that are so sad. And I think the fact you have been so honest about, you know, your mental health at one point and getting that checked, how the dynamics of your family has changed. I think that's something that people don't talk about. There's so many levels to grief and how it affects people. And you're so tanned and I'm so jealous. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you more.
Kathy's strength and determination is incredible. Not only did she raise thousands of euro to remember her sister, Kathy also supports others through her online chats on the Grief Ireland Instagram page. Kathy is incredibly open and giving and really helping people process, grow and heal. I thank her so much for sharing her story with me today. Next time on Death Becomes Him, I talk to Brona Burke. Brona's story is a lesson in appreciating every moment in life. Her and her husband Thomas had incredible plans for life. They loved spending time with their twins, were looking forward to planning holidays, and had just moved into their forever home. Tragically, Thomas passed suddenly in April 2020. Brona talks about the trauma and the little signs she sees that prove Thomas is still looking after her.
Why me? Why give me so much pain? You know, why give me so much pain, a space of 5 years, but give me so much joy as well? And, you know, why take a good one of the good guys away